Today, Kamala gave us the topic for the discussion today, and I think it's a really good one. She's studying the psychology of religion. She's taking courses in this. And she's also studying Jungian psychology, which is, of course, relevant to people who are astrologers and psychotherapists. And I have been dealing with people who are struggling with the issue we're about to speak of today all week long. And I can say with confidence that every single person in the world has to deal with this in the exact same way. Now, I'm going to avoid technical terms because I don't think they really describe things better than common sense terms. In common sense terms, all of us have to deal with developing ourselves as individuals. It also could be spoken of as finding yourself. But then you've got this problem that there are always groups of people who you are part of who are defining you for you. Those groups may be your family, the first group, your friends, the secondary groups, the organizations or religions you belong to, your culture, your political system of your country. All of these things define you. And it's often the case that people lose their capacity to manifest their individuality when overwhelmed with such an enormous pressure from groups around them. Now, for us who are spiritualists, us who are very concerned about spirituality, very concerned about God, very concerned about service, very concerned about advancement, this becomes a very significant issue. And it becomes significant from multiple points of view, not just one. For those of us who are spiritualists, we have a very significant problem dealing with the definitions given to us from literatures, scriptures, shastras, the revealed texts which define a religion. These texts give stories of people who are good examples of the religion. They give stories of people who are bad examples of religion. They give stories about prophets. So we have role models, those who we should follow. We have models of those who we should not be like. And then you have the situation of the ideals given by the literatures. Now you take that very extremely difficult standard to live up to, and you put that in a social context in a religion. And you've got the people who are also in your religion, people who believe like you believe. Then you've got the situation where everybody is policing everybody else subtly. Are you actually following what you're supposed to follow? And then you've got the situation where people are checking out if what you are doing is correct from the point of view of their expectations of you. When we have these group expectations on us that are born of a philosophy, born of a standard, of a discipline, and so on, it puts a lot of pressure on us to conform to the expectations of the group. Now, as far as certain churches are concerned, this is not a problem. As far as certain groups are concerned, this is not a problem. Because after all, when you transform your life from the, now I'm quoting, sinful, degraded, or materialistic way it was running to this spiritual way, you've done something good. And that's actually a reasonable point to a certain extent. I mean, if you take somebody who has no real experience with spirituality, and then you gradually bring them through some systematic process, you can assist them very well to develop spirituality which was ordinarily absent. Yet at the same time, you have the problem of redefining a person without very carefully considering the person. So then you've got groups which are against various forms of religion or against different groups on this very basis. They say it creates a loss of individuality. And actually, to a certain extent, this may be a reasonable claim, because people tend to put themselves secondarily to the requirements of their group. This conversation or this discussion becomes very nasty when people start using words like people in this religion or people in this group or whatever are brainwashed, or they are zombies, or they are blind followers. So you have to see this situation from the point of view of, well, what about the individual? And what about the individual's requirements to be nurtured within a group environment? Now, you might remember that we have talked often in the past about the process of individuation. And this is also a term used in Jungian philosophy. It's actually just a, shall we say, very nice way of speaking about the process of becoming an individual. Yet that sounds also funny, because we are individuals. We don't have to become individuals. And nothing we can do can change the fact that we are individuals. But because we surrender our individuality in many ways, we need to speak about individuation, because it specifically refers to the way in which the individual declares himself to be what he is within the context of a group. Now, actually, I've had this conversation in many ways and in many contexts with Kamala Mulla. He's the main person I speak with this about. He's always making me look at it from the point of view of, yeah, but what about, how do you take somebody who's not very developed and how do you bring him to the point of being developed? I mean, this is a very good point. If you analyze what I say, if you listen to all my lectures, it presumes an enormous amount of experience or knowledge or evolution. I'm talking from the point of view of somebody who's been there and done that as far as religious groups. So I'm talking from the other side of having gone through this whole process of individuation. Now, what's interesting when you think about this is that what I'm talking about and how I'm talking about, actually, I'm talking to people who are already very experienced, already very knowledgeable in many ways. So Kamala Mulla always says, well, wait a minute, what about everybody else? And I always go, I don't really answer it directly. And the reason I don't answer it directly is because I don't really know how to answer it. Now, the problem is enormous. Just think about it. You've got an individual. For him to advance, he needs the support of a group. As soon as he gets the support of a group, he loses his individuality. Then he has to somehow or another get what he's supposed to get from the group and regain his individuality. Now, I did that, and I know a lot of you did that too. And it is a very painful process. This is not something you want to have everybody do. So me and my idealism, I'm trying to find a way to avoid all that. I'm trying to circumvent that whole thing. How you can get to God, how you can get to the Supreme without having to be crushed by dogma or expectations? Well, that is very, very difficult. Let's look at this from another point of view. I'm not saying it's impossible, but let's look at this from another point of view. We'll start off with ourselves as individuals when we take birth. We'll talk about the family. And then later on, I'm going to try to put that in an analogous situation with being within a spiritual organization. You know, there are many people who have been in a spiritual organization, look back on it and say, oh, that was so bad. There are many people who've been in a family and looked back on it and said, oh, that was so bad. Now, in many cases, I don't mean all of them, and there's a lot of abuse in families, as there are a lot of abuse in organizations. But in many cases, after a while, after more experiences, you look back on this and you say, well, there was a reason. There were good things in there and they helped me. Before I start this, I just want to say one thing about me is that I may be very upset in many cases or some cases about certain aspects of the experience I went through. But if anyone asked me today, do I regret having gone through it? Would I have done it another kind of a thing? I would say, no, I had enormous opportunities to experience, and it was all in all useful for me. Would I go back to it now? No, sorry. Would I go back to my family? Would I live with my mother and father now? No, sorry. But that doesn't mean that I have to see it as like some kind of a negative thing. I see it for what it was, experiences, great expansion of my capacities and abilities and knowledge. I thought it was a great experience from that point of view. Okay, having said that, let's get into a discussion of how the individual and the group interact and struggle. We are all born into a family. The family is the first group we know. Now, if one is against groups and is a total individual, let him or her go back and think about the family, which is the first primal group in all our existence, all our lives. Now, when you're a little baby, when you're a child, when you're growing up, you absolutely require a family. I know those who don't have a family are miserable and cannot live in this in a normal way. So a family is the first experience we have of groups, and it's a very, very significant and important one without which we cannot live. So here we have immediately a very important example that we can talk about, how the individual is very dependent on that familial group. What are we dependent on? Well, food, shelter, safety, security, entertainment, and many other things, health. And as we live in that group of the family, we are educated, we are allowed to grow, we are allowed to develop friendship with others who are in a similar situation. Now, when we are little babies, we express our individuality by being very charming, being very wonderful, and everybody wants to hold us and take care of us and so on. But when we go to school and when we are amongst groups of friends, we end up with this situation where we are, shall we say, losing our uniqueness. We are becoming more of the crowd kind of a thing. Especially when you have other brothers and sisters. If you're an only child, it may be different. But when you have a lot of brothers and sisters or whatever, there's a struggle there to maintain your individuality even within the family. Some people manifest their individuality within large families by being very strange or rebellious or doing completely the opposite of what everybody else is doing. Others just become very quiet and go out and do whatever they want and don't tell anybody about it. Teenagers always have this need to manifest their individuality. And at that point, parents are severely challenged. Because from the parents' point of view, we're a group. We're a family. As a family, we have expectations and standards. But the child who's in the teenage years, powered by puberty, starts to feel, I must be myself. I must do things for myself. Because puberty demands privacy. Unless you are in a very enlightened culture, which we're not. So then you have this situation where the individual puts signs on the door, do not come in my room, off limits, my room only. Well, let's look at it from this point of view. as they are developing their independence, it's not happening, but they're actually developing, to a small extent, their independence from their family, they are becoming more dependent on their new group, the friends. And this new group, the friends, has its own standards. It has its own expectations, its own form of acceptable dress, its own form of acceptable activities. And what happens at that point is that you're now entering into another group. And in that other group, you're losing your individuality. But you're thinking that this is what you want to do, that it's your individual choice to do it, unlike entering into your family, which you think is not your choice. Well, in actuality, that family is your choice, but that's not the point here. The point is that you now think that it's your choice. You're making that choice with full understanding to be in this group of friends. And according to your personal qualities, according to your personal characteristics, according to the way you are, the group of friends you choose is accordingly chosen. Now, why is it that all religious groups everywhere, all around the world, no matter who they are, go after late teens, early 20s for their new recruits? I suggest it's because when they leave the family group and they are in this in-between stage where they're looking at the world and the responsibilities of the world, they see, oh, that's very different. Don't forget, even if you are being a rebel, whatever you may be against your family, you have a place to eat, a place to sleep, someone who takes care of your health, someone who gives you security, someone who gets you clothes, and so on, entertainment. So although you think you're becoming independent by going with your friends and whatever, in reality, you're still economically and in many ways dependent. So one of the ways in which one grows up is a rite of passage when one is about to leave the home. It's a rite of passage when you're going to stand on your own two feet. Now, here you are on the gateway to leaving the home, and you look out there and you see, well, you're going to have to get a job. You're going to have to make money. You're going to have to take care of yourself. You're going to have to even feed yourself. You're going to have to do all these things yourself. And depending on who you are, you'll go in a certain direction. Now, okay, we're talking about spiritualists here because we are spiritualists. We're interested in spiritual things and religious things and things which have to do with the divine and the living entity and so on. So we're going to talk about that kind of person. So here we have that kind of a person, us, faced with this choice, and then looking around and seeing this opportunity to do something spiritual and at the same time have in a group food, shelter, being taken care of, security. So in many practical ways, it's a natural flow from the family to the independence to the other kind of family, often called spiritual family, within which one feels the same kind of a protected bubble one had at home. But in this situation, it's a spiritual context. You feel justified. You feel God is on your side. Can you imagine now? God is on your side. You have left your materialistic home and you have found a new home which is spiritual and there's no more materialism and now God is on your side and everybody else doesn't get it. And then your family comes to visit you and you say, you don't get it because God's on my side. God's not on your side. Because you are sinful and I am not. You are going to face all kinds of karmic reactions. I'm getting freed from that. So another form of identification starts to take place as a negation of the sinful people that are everywhere throughout the world. where we define ourselves through negation by seeing all kinds of sinful people around the world and saying, I'm not one of them. I'm in this bubble of safety. I'm in this oasis, in this desert of materialism, and this oasis shall carry me forth. And if I have to lose my individuality to this understanding and be what it means to be this pure soul who goes back to God, freed from this desert, so be it. I like it. Now, in every religious group, there is a honeymoon period where you first come from the horrible vision of the material existence, and you come into the spiritual existence, and for some period of time, some years, you just feel, just, this is it. I have really made it. I'm now going to solve all those problems. And now I'm going to go out and preach the word. I'm going to preach the message. I'm going to save the world. Because this is right. God is on my side. Every other person needs this because they are sick with the materialistic virus. Now, after a while, this wears off. And the individuality starts to manifest again. The need to be an individual within this group starts to manifest. So a little bit of rebellion, or shall we say, carving out one's place starts to take place. Instead of the communal existence, one wants some special facility. To be seen in a special way, to have some uniqueness. Perhaps a managerial position or some kind of spiritual position where one is recognized. And one tries to define oneself in terms of these acquisitions. Yet there comes a time when this isn't working and one requires to look at oneself in the mirror and understand what is it that I want as a person. And then sometimes that person moves away from this, looking for, again, how to define themselves as individuals. And then one feels lonely and needs a group. And in this way, we have this constant intertwining of the need for having the support of others within a social environment and in defining ourselves as an individual. It's probably the primary, most significant struggle we have in our lives. And it's continually going on. In fact, it's there at every moment. What do I want? Yet, what does the group expect? Whatever that group may be. Could be society, family, friends, anything. And how do I deal with the two? Okay, so that's clear. Now let's go back to this point about, you know, this discussion. Even though we don't talk about it directly, that Kamala Malaha and I have all the time. How do you take somebody who doesn't know anything and bring him to the point where he knows he can have some tools and know something? And again, it's a question I've never been able to answer. I don't really have an answer, but let's try to understand it more clearly. It might help. Now, I understand that things that I have been speaking about, things that I have realized or my experiences in this life, are very much dependent on the experiences of my past. I would have to be a liar or some kind of illusionist to try to say that what I'm saying and what I have been speaking about is a product of me, is something that comes from me alone. I'm a product of my family, my genes, my DNA are biologically given to me. I'm behaviorally modified from having grown up in the places where I grew up, by all the places I've lived in through my life. But spiritually, it's very significant how I have been influenced, and positively so, by the different spiritual traditions I have been within. I have not only been within the Vaishnava tradition, I've been in other groups as well. And I feel that there are very, very important things I've learned. Essential things. Without these essential things, my spirituality, my development would be different. Maybe it would have been harder. I don't know. I can't say. I cannot answer the question, what would you have been like had you not joined this group or not been part of that group? I cannot answer that question. It's totally a fantasy to try to even think about it. But I can answer the question, what did you get that was of such an essence, such an importance, that it helped you become what you are? In other words, what did you get as an individual? As an individual who was growing and developing, that assisted you to become what you are today, whatever that may be? Well, that's very easy to answer. And I can make a list. It'll be a long list. I can give a short list now. Many wonderful mantras, which may be internally meditated with or chanted out loud. A beautiful deity worship where I may have a way to manifest my connection with Radha and Krishna or Lord Chaitanya, Lord Nityananda, or other deities. A feeling of being of service and an actual practical experience of how you can do that. It seems to me this is the essence, and it seems to me that there are certain personal qualities which are very important for everyone to have. Basic important qualities of the mode of goodness, you know, like cleanliness and kindness and honesty and mercy and compassion and forgiveness and so on. So there are good qualities one can develop. There's ways in which one can manifest these good qualities in service. And there's knowledge of the divine and the supreme and the capacity to make the connection. So if I were to make that answer clearer, like, let's say if I were to be having this discussion right now with Kamala Mulla directly, which it would be like, okay, he prints these books. They may not be directly Shastra in that sense, but they help people develop knowledge and experiences. Now, I hope I'm not embarrassing him by speaking about this. That's not my point. He's the only person who's ever asked me this question. He's the only person who brings this up consistently, and I feel it's the most significant question I personally have to answer. I mean, think about it. We're all getting older. I mean, I'm sorry to say it. I mean, I know it's horrible to think about, but when we look in the mirror, we see these gray hairs are starting to come out. Now then, what someone may say, wait a minute. You're talking about perpetuating something. But what is the something that you're perpetuating? And I'm going, oh my God, there it is again, perpetuation. How the challenge of being remembered, the challenge of offering something that stands and lasts. Now, I know very clearly that there will be many others that follow me, that follow you, that follow all of those who are teaching today, who will have a much clearer, much better way of presenting spirituality. And I actually would be very happy with not being remembered, because after all, I'm going to be dead anyway. So whether anybody remembers me or not doesn't really affect me. And I'm only talking about me in this case because I can only speak on my own behalf. I can't speak on your behalf. Yet I like quality. I like things which are quality things. Why do people like the books that Kamala Mulla publishes? Well, I don't mean to blow my own trumpet, but I pick them. That's my job. I get these piles of books. Sometimes you can't imagine how many books I get. I get boxes and boxes of books. And some of the books I open up and I go, oh my God, how did this thing ever get published? Toss that one. I pick up another one and I go, oh good God, who taught this guy how to write English? I pick up another one and I go, oh, what boring junk. And every now and then I pick them up and I go, whoa, wow, is that good? You know, just like my sister gave me for my birthday, a book by Eckhart Tolle called A New Earth. And I read this book and I go, what planet did this man come from? Every sentence is written so perfectly. I can't believe it. I like quality when they write really perfectly. When things go one sentence, perfect, 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 perfect. I'm mystified by it. Now, of course, he says some things about his conclusions about spirituality, which I'm not terribly happy with, but that's another point. Now, at the same time, I like anything that is quality like this. I listen to some music and it's like, geez, that's just fabulous. I watch some movies and I go, my God, that's just like extraordinary. And it's like you appreciate quality. You appreciate the devotion that somebody has put in a painting. You just look at it and you go, this is really art. I look for that quality. I look for that consciousness which is manifesting in the expression. Now, even though this discussion every Saturday is spontaneous, for example, 5 minutes before I walked in here to start speaking, I had no idea what I was going to talk about. But if I were to sit here and babble, I would not be able to tolerate myself. I would shut down this whole Saturday broadcast. Because I have my own standards of quality. Something has to be quality. And that which is quality lasts. That which is quality creates the foundation upon which other manifestations or expressions of quality develop in the future. So when I'm dead and gone and I'm up there in the in-between life and I'm looking down here on the earth and I see others standing on the foundation of what I have tried to present, which is standing on the foundation of what others have tried to present, I will feel very good about my life. I would feel very unhappy if people remembered me and said, oh boy, he was so good at this or that or the other thing, yet it meant nothing for the future. But if I could be of service to the evolution of this world, of the evolution of individuals within it, I would feel very valuable as a person. Now see the struggle between individuation and the society. The society is a group. I wish it to evolve. I wish it to grow. To do that, I have to be part of it. And yet, I have to offer it my service in such a qualitative manner that it becomes of value to the group. Or individuals within the societal group who can develop. So my concern as an individual, my individuation process right now is very different than my individuation process when I was 20 or 25. Now, I am not following other personalities' ideals as to what is the goal, what is the direction, what is the discipline, what is the manner of expression. If what I say or do happens to be similar to what others say or do, that's, I consider, coincidental to some extent, but it doesn't bother me. It's just something that's going on naturally. But I'm making choices myself. I consider this right, this wrong. This is something I should do. This is something I should not do. This is what I should say. This is what I should not say. And I shall try to express it in the highest form of quality, clearly, and without, as much as possible, without my own distorted twist on things as I can. Now, what I do now is I'm trying to do something, and it's a question of expression that I feel is good for those who wish to take it. And if you wish to hear, if you wish to cooperate, I think that's nice. In that sense, we are a group. But then again, you've got this problem. We don't have rules. We don't have regulations. We don't have disciplines. We don't have expectations that you should be a certain way. Now, let's question that. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing, or is that a neutral thing that really isn't part of any evolutionary development? But then again, let's get back to the real point, is that you people already are experienced. You people already are evolved. And as a general group, you are falling into the developing gray hair category. So how does this have relevance to general, generic evolution in a regular society which had bred the youth as the future? How does one take that one who knows nothing and bring them to a point of knowing something? Is there somebody who knows nothing? Does that even exist? And is there a knowledge which is so important that they should learn it? Does it matter that there are no young people doing it? Is it important that it continues in this way? Is it that I have to have bricks which mate and produce little bricks, baby bricks, or they just remain as part of a building that keeps getting built higher and higher? A very esoteric point, wasn't it? If you caught what I just said, that's a very esoteric point. Even if the bricks did mate and produce little bricks, what in heaven's name is it that we are doing that needs to be continued in time? Well, let's go back to these essential points, because here's the answer. The answer lies in essence. You've got the Supreme, Radha and Krishna. Very specifically, the combination of the male and female, Radha and Krishna. Or Lord Chaitanya, who's also that combination. Deities. You've got mantras, you've got meditations, you've got Eastern forms of disciplines and transcendence. Well, wait a minute. How do you perpetuate that? Well, there are people out there already doing it. There's all kinds of Hindu kind of things, Vaishnav kind of things, all over the place doing just that. And of course they're arguing with each other. Of course they're condemning each other. And of course many who join such groups end up being in the situation of having lost their individuality. Now, how would I, for instance, change that? Let's put me, God forbid, but this is just a theoretical example. Let's put me in charge of developing such a thing. What would I have to do? I'd have to make a temple. And my temple would have to have deities, and to do it right, there would have to be certain standards, certain things you have to learn. To learn, there has to be classes. There has to be standards of what you can do, you can't do. There has to be an economic basis to the temple. And so we have to be very concerned with bringing in money. There's legal status, there's tax status, maintaining a building, keeping it clean, feeding everybody, management, hierarchy. Pull your hair out, you got the same thing. I don't believe I could do it any better. So I avoid it. So here I am in this like elitist position. Just think about it like this. I'm in this elitist position. You've got all those Hindus out there doing all the dirty work of getting people involved in Radha and Krishna. And then you've got this elitist over here who's going to tell them when they finally get finished with all that, how to really make that connection. It's unbearable arrogance. That's how, if I were to look in the mirror and think like that, I would say, this person is unbearably arrogant. So I sit down and I scratch my head. Well, what am I going to do? I can't go that way. I can't go this way. I've got myself wrapped up in this knot. I would be a perfect candidate for a Woody Allen movie, if you know what that means. Okay, now, what does a person like me do? Well, what I do is all I can do. I can't do what I can't do. I can only do what I can do. So I sit here on Saturday and I talk. And for some reason I can't understand, you guys listen. So as long as you listen, I talk. When you stop listening, I stop talking. And I suppose the only way I can deal with this as a person is to respect everybody's role in this global evolutionary process. I respect all the Hindus. I respect the Vaishnavas. They're doing great work. I respect many of the Buddhists for just developing such good qualities and characteristics in so many people. I have to respect all spiritual leaders and teachers and authors of all these great books. For example, the ones that we publish in the publishing house there, they're just such good persons. Okay, let's put it this way. I've just got to respect all people everywhere and their contribution to the world and understand my context within that world, which is very simple. I do the best I can with the best motivation I can, with the best just dedication and devotion I can. And I try to avoid thinking of myself as somebody important or thinking of myself as something significant and just continue to focus on the quality of it and respect as much as I can everybody's contribution to this great effort. Even if I personally would not be part of what they are doing, I respect it as parts of the whole. Now, when you think about what Lord Chaitanya said, to be humbler than the blade of grass and more tolerant than the straw in the street and like the tree that offers all kinds of shelter, basically all religion boils down to that. All spirituality boils down to you being the very best person you can be and doing the right thing for yourself and others. And keeping yourself connected with the divine, with Radha and Krishna, with Lord Chaitanya. And thus, through you, others feel that connection. They feel that shelter. They feel part of that family. What more can you do? So, if I were to now... I really wish we could have, me and Kamala Mala could have had this discussion interactively. It would have been a lot more fun. But we have to deal with translators, so it's not happening. But if he were to again challenge me, as he does, and rightfully so, what can I say? What can I do for those who don't know? I would say, well, I don't know. I can only do what I can do. I can't do more. But may God forgive me for the next statement. You can do, if you feel, you should do this for them. Do it. I'm one little guy doing what I can do. I really can't do more than that. Now, already it has been stated, and you all accepted it, nobody objected, that you are all experienced, advanced personalities in your own way. And you can, in whatever way you feel, you can be of service to the world by offering your experience, your knowledge, your capacities. Do you know that I used to be a school teacher? I don't know if you knew that. I taught 7th grade social studies. They were about, 12 years old. And we had to define what age we wanted to teach because there were different programs you could go through to get educated in a particular method of teaching. A very special kind of a person dealt with the young kids in kindergarten. A very special kind of a person dealt with the young kids in like ages 1 through 3, another one through 4, 5, and 6, another one in the junior high school, another one in the high school. I felt very comfortable with the kids in junior high school. I'll tell you why in a second. Because I felt that they were older than the young kids who had so many other kinds of problems I didn't feel like dealing with. And they were not so ruined as the older kids who were just really rebellious. So I chose the 7th, 8th grade because I thought that would be really great. I would avoid all of that. Boy, was I wrong. I got the worst of all of it. I thought I would avoid all of the childishness and all the rebellion. Instead, I got the childish rebels. But anyway, what I meant to say by this example was not that any one who teaches on this level, that level, the other level, that you're better or you're worse. For example, we live in Gainesville, Florida. The University of Florida is here. We know people who are professors. And generally, professors never listen to you. They're not interested in you. They want to just talk to you. And such persons are basically persons who are not very evolved in themselves. They may not even be very good teachers. They may not even have much experience in the world because they've just been in school the whole time, getting their doctorates, becoming big, big learned persons, writing books. And just being very, having all these letters after your name doesn't mean you're a good teacher. Whereas you may have a kindergarten teacher who just takes care of these little kids and is somehow or another helping them evolve into social beings who may be so much more capable of dealing with people. So it doesn't matter what level you teach on. That doesn't make you better or worse. So if you feel the inclination to assist those in this age group or that kind of demography, fine. After all, the spiritual principle is to be of service. In whatever way you as an individual can be of service by using your individual capacities, using your individual experiences to assist others, be my guest. So not only do I say be my guest, but I encourage you, because I think it's really good. The more we can do for this planet, the more we can do to assist in the global evolution of this planet, it just is a really good thing. And I would like to apologize if some things I've said in the past seem to tear apart the structure or fiber of other organizations which are trying to be of service in their own particular way. That doesn't mean that I would advise us or any of us to do things like that. I'm just saying that everybody has their role to play. Because as far as I'm concerned, the major transformation is from the balancing, learning to balance, the major challenge. Let's start that all over again. The major challenge is in this life is to learning to balance our individuality through the process of individuation within the context of a group. And so I suppose what I'm doing now is just that. Yet, how you relate as an individual within whatever groups you already are relating is your challenge. Anyway, I wish us luck, because it's a great challenge and it's just really wonderful that we have taken up this challenge in our lives. I applaud all of us. I think we're really good for having done it. I think we're really bold. I think we're very courageous. And I, as an individual, wish to give us a big hug. So today I'm going to start off with the questions of Natasha, because after all, Sudo and Natasha are giving up all their time and doing such great service there by offering this translation to all of us. I believe that life's experience is the most valuable possession a human being has in this life. All his and her grievances, joyousness, and highest strivings are in this. In almost all spiritual groups of the modern time, practically no attention is paid to the real experiences of particular individuals within the group. And in some places, it's even forbidden to talk about oneself due to these dogmatic rules. I think that in a spiritual group, there is no final loss of individuality in a sense that Jung was writing about it. Rather, the mood is to suppress the revelation of the personal experiences of the people. It seems that people don't know much about each other, or practically nothing about each other, even though they have been in the same group or attending the same group for many years. And she comments that if a spiritual group would appreciate the real experiences of every individual and have this as its highest value, then our individual sincerity would allow us to approach the ideal of a real world or real human people brotherhood. And so the question is, what do you think about that? And what I think? Well, I think, of course, it's true what you've said. I think everything you've said is true. And I saw that myself in my final days in a particular group, that my personal experiences became meaningless to others. They became actually something that would frighten them or bring about the opinion that it was craziness. And if you remember when we have spoken about one of the main problems we have when we're in front of the deity or when we're having a spiritual experience is that we tend to reject it because we feel it can't be so. Now, last week we had a very deep experience together and a very deep meditation together. And many people had very extraordinary realizations. And some of them wrote to me and said, I had this extraordinary realization, I had this extraordinary experience, could it possibly be real? They asked me, could you confirm this? And I kind of like, I got annoyed. I remember when we had this traveling meditation. We had this traveling meditation where we went out into the universe together and everybody had some really deep experiences. And some people were so shocked by their experience that they just couldn't believe it. So they went to some other spiritual teacher and asked her, was it real? And she said, no, you could not have traveled there. It's all in your mind. And I got annoyed. I mean, I haven't said anything because I don't even know if that person actually said that, but it's like annoying when people do that. I have an experience that I experience, and then somebody else comes and says, you didn't experience that. Now, how stupid would I have to be to believe somebody else who didn't experience what I experienced, telling me that I didn't experience what I experienced? And in a similar way, I'm annoyed when somebody asks me to tell them if what they experienced was what they experienced. Now, I would have to be, again, disgustingly arrogant to take the position of saying that, yes, yes, you experienced what you experienced. I hereby confirm that you have experienced. Do you realize what kind of a nonsense I would have to be to say that? Okay, so now somebody may object. They may say, well, what if what I experienced was actually an illusion? Some people might say, they might object. They might, you know, want to question that it is, what if what I experienced was actually illusory? The experience, what I thought the experience was illusory. Because after all, we are programmed that everything has to be real. It cannot be illusory. Because if it's illusory, it has no value. And if it's real, it has value. Now, a lot of people think like this, not just a few. Practically everybody thinks like this. But I challenge that. I say, when you go to the movie, it's an illusion, and you are experiencing pleasure. Is that pleasure real or not, even though the movie's illusion? The hero died. You feel pain. Is that bad? But then somebody will say, but my spiritual experiences have to be real. I mean, here I was feeling this deep connection to God. I mean, feeling this connection to Krishna or to Radha, or I felt this deep connection. I mean, what if it was an illusion? I would be guilty of being an illusion. Now, naturally, I must be an illusion because I have no connection to Radha and Krishna. I can't connect to Radha and Krishna. I can't have any realization of God. Me? Are you kidding? I'm so sinful. I'm so fallen. I'm so terrible. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea culpa. So if I have any experience, it has to be, by definition, illusory. So I have to go to some authority, and I have to ask the authority, did I experience what I experienced, or was it an illusion? Which it must be. Because obviously, you would never go to somebody and ask them, did I experience what I experienced? Unless you believed very deeply that you didn't experience what you experienced. And naturally, the authority, knowing this, will tell you, don't be ridiculous. Of course you didn't experience what you experienced. It was all a fantasy. So it annoys me when people ask me if they experienced what they experienced. So let's make a rule. Don't ask me, did I experience what I experienced? And a little bit of advice. Don't worry about it. Your experiences are great. They are your experiences. Embrace them. You have contact with God? Embrace it. Don't reject it thinking that you can't. And if you really think you can't have this experience, then don't try to get it. If I say, we're now going to have this experience, and we're now going to connect to Radha and Krishna, then you should say, oh, sorry, I can't do that, and run out the door as fast as you can. Because if you continue, you're going to run a very, very serious danger of experiencing something that you can't experience. And that's going to cause you a lot of trouble. Because first of all, you're not allowed to have such experiences. Second of all, it's not possible for you to have such experience. And third of all, if you do have such experience, it means you're somewhat crazy. And then after all of that, you're going to have to take time. You're going to have to take a bus. You're going to have to take a train. Or you're going to have to drive somewhere where there's an authority so that the authority can tell you what you already know, which is that you're crazy, you didn't have the experience. Now, this is real. What I just talked about, this is not like my making a comedy routine out of a very small point. This is a very major point. I don't need to work hard to make it funny. It is funny by all by itself. Doesn't need me to twist it into something funny. Have enough faith in yourself that at least you can believe that what you are experiencing is an experience. So the first thing you must say is, I experience what I experience. And nobody can tell me I don't experience what I experience. Let that sink in. And I don't need to ask anybody if my experience is real. If it's real, you feel it's real. If it's not real, you know it's not real. For example, I think I'm God. I'm now going to make this, it's all cloudy here where I am right now. I'm now going to part the clouds and I'm going to make them go away so the sun comes out. So I'm going to meditate here and in my mind I see those clouds just going away. Now I just did that and in fact in my consciousness, my mind, the clouds went away. But when I look out the window, they're still there. So if I say my experience was I moved the clouds, that's illusion. If I say, in my meditation, the clouds moved, that's my experience. But if I'm in a meditation, and my meditation is trying to contact Radha and Krishna, in meditation, and I actually feel that contact, I feel the contact, it's real. If I don't feel it, it could be just a thought. Experience means you have a variety of ways in which you experience it. And you have to learn. And I'm sorry to be so absolute in that statement. But you really have to learn to believe in yourself. I mean, what is the use of entering into a spiritual discipline if when you get any experience of it, you have to, by definition, reject it? Because that is the absolute number one way to make sure you do not have these experiences. You do not so-called advance. And when you have experiences, you embrace the experiences, you own those experiences, more of them come. So similarly, getting back to this comment, no one has the right to question your experience. However, if somebody does question your experience, you don't have to take it seriously. When that other spiritual, so-called, she's spiritual, said that you didn't, to that person, you didn't experience what you experienced, I said, who cares what she says? What does she know? She's never experienced what we experience. She experiences what she experiences. That's the law. Nobody, doesn't matter who they are, can judge, condemn, or negate your experiences. Okay, maybe somebody can help you understand your own experiences better. Like, for example, why did I have this experience? What would be good to learn from this experience? How can I reproduce this experience? How can I avoid this negative experience? These questions get answers which are supportive of you, supportive of your experience. And I think this is exactly what Natasha is getting at, that spirituality, groups of spiritual people have to support each other's experiences, not negate each other's experiences. Encourage each other's experiences. Applaud each other's experiences. This is the real purpose of a spiritual group, to bring out the best of all individuals. Okay, that may have sounded very idealistic, but it's not that difficult to do. Each one of us just have to say, I respect your experiences. I embrace your experiences. I applaud you for them. I encourage you for them. I'm talking now about those transformative experiences, those spiritual experiences. And if somebody comes and says, I've had this negative experience, we support them to find the way through it. So instead of being people who crush each other, we're people who help us grow. Now we're going to move over to the piles of questions and piles of comments coming from Kamala Mullah's flat. And again, here somebody over there is asking a question that can you develop love of God alone without the help of a group or without the help of a guru? Okay. Now, again, the whole point of what we spoke about today is that nobody stands alone. Everybody needs support. We need some kind of support within which we grow and nourish. We need to hear from and experience together with those who've had more experiences or know how to speak about their experiences in a way which help you. I mean, this is just nature. But then again, it's the exact same point. As a group, we should nourish each other. And even if there are others who have more experience, and I use that phrase very loosely, have more knowledge or whatever, they should be willing to share it with us as a facilitator, not dictator. Let's take anybody, a brother, a sister, older brother, older sister, usually it's like this, or a father, or a mother, or a teacher. Whenever they say, you must be like this, what happens? Whenever you are being pushed into, forced into a certain mold, being pushed to be a certain way, how does that make you feel? Well, it either makes you feel very bad, or if you feel you have to go through it, you make yourself very dull somehow or another, so you don't feel bad about it. Neither of these states are useful. And simply spending your life rebelling against what other people are forcing you to be is also not useful, because then you can't really be what you want to be. You got to be what they don't want you to be. And even if you don't mind being, even if you like being what they want you to be, because they're pushing you to be it, you've got to be something else. And that totally screws up your life. So, you know, this question is, again, it's going back to the very essence of what it means to be in a group, what it means to be in a religion, what it means to be in a spiritual discipline. We need support. We need nourishment. We need knowledge. We need somebody to guide us through experiences. Yes, we need that. And I'm very familiar with the idea that it's already there within us. We are already perfect and complete in ourselves. But when you don't know that, you need a way to get to that point. So you need that help. However, that help should come in the format I just explained, which is a facilitation, not a demand. No, demand, not. And so therefore, I hate, some people can't stand when I use that word. It really makes my life difficult to have to deal with this word, guru. Because everybody has this somewhere or other idea that guru somehow means the one who's going to do it all and I'm going to get right where I got to go. And sorry, I don't believe that anymore. So therefore, I don't like the word. Spiritual mentor, spiritual coach, spiritual facilitator. Even ministering, minister is a great word because minister means to serve, to minister. These are okay words. But when you say guru or maybe pope or bishop or, you know, self-realized masters, you're starting to get into dangerous ground. It starts to get shaky here. I mean, you get scared. I mean, it's like, the fear of God has descended upon me. And they say guru is heavy, and boy, does it feel like it. You get this like heavy weight on you, just like of the heavy, heavy, heavy. You know, my God, I got to surrender. It's like, yes, yes. Okay, don't forget there's a lot of smiling of and kissing of babies and patting on the head and accepting of gifts and all that. I understand there's a lot of hoopla around it, which makes it all very, very pleasant. So here I am being forced to be against something that is okay only because others demand it must be like that. Isn't it horrible? Look at Lord Chaitanya's times, the gurus. They were very different. All of those personalities who acted as teachers, as gurus, as assistants, as facilitators, they were totally different than the modern format of it. The whole scene was different. You didn't have them riding on elephants. You didn't have them with garlands. You didn't have them with marching bands. You didn't have them with all these ceremonies, fantastic things. They were just very spiritual, extremely realized, willing to share. And anyway, I don't even care if the historical example may be different in some cases. That's not my point. My point is that now we need mentors. We need facilitators, people who actually care about you becoming as great as you can be. And people who are not emotionally or psychologically or economically dependent on those who they teach. Neither those who are creating their identity through the position they have. So, therefore, the ideal is that whoever you are, because even within groups there are hierarchies, people who know more, know less, who are better at this, better, whoever you are, we don't need guru in group. Everybody is within it together. Whoever you are, just be a facilitator, a mentor, be of service as you can. So I think that is my opinion about this. I'm going to give you one person's realization about how she has been benefited by this facilitation that we do here every week. She said, through meditations from your broadcast, I had wonderful experiences. Angels and deities embraced me. All my chakras became happy. I can experience unlimited space. And I can feel brothers and sisters around the world. And I hope I get this right. She says a big crystal into earth, but I think she means that vibrant effulgence of this planet, this crystalline effulgence. Now, you know, I mean, I think that's great. I think it's great you have these experiences. For me, that is the absolute most encouraging thing. I know this question comes up because there are qualitative differences between the manner in which a presentation is made about spirituality, about experiential understanding of divinity. Obviously, there are many forms of spirituality. There are many methods of expressing it. Some people express it vastly different than others. So the question is, how should one react to groups of people who are trying very hard to present the personality of God as a very ambitious, frightening person that everyone should fear and who punishes us directly or indirectly? In other words, the particular worry here is that, well, okay, you can respect, remember we talked about it, others, you can respect the methodologies they use to bring people to God. Okay, it's part of the whole process by which we learn to individuate ourselves and so on. Yet what if they present things in such a way which is so wrong, so incompatible, how am I supposed to deal with that? Okay, now this brings us into the frightening area of religion, because, you know, some religions think others are crazy, so they attack them, want to destroy them. So we have in society, of course, some ideal that there's freedom of religion. You can think what you want. Other people can say what they want. We're not going to judge what you're saying. So I make my statement about what they're doing by not being part of what they're doing. I don't go there. I don't support them in any way. But if one is to ask me what is right, quote unquote, what is best, what I think is best, I would say, I don't think that's the kind of God that I'm interested in. I don't like that kind of God where I'm supposed to feel afraid. I don't like that kind of understanding of God where this is punishing. I believe in the God of love. Now they may say, and they will, that we don't care what you believe. God is this kind of a God, and because you just don't understand it, you're going to get smashed, because that's karma. I remember about 18 or so years ago, my mother and I were having a male conversation. I remember. And I had mentioned that I wasn't feeling well. I was kind of sick and just hanging out and doing nothing. And she wrote to me and said, well, where's your philosophy now? She said, you told me you were sick because you were so sinful. These are your reactions. So she said, well, look at me. I eat meat, fish, and eggs. I do everything you're not supposed to do. I am a very sinful person, and I am perfectly healthy. I have money, nice house, everything's fine. I have a problem. I have a very intelligent mother. You know, you have to really watch it when you do this kind of discussion with my mother. That letter really made me think, let me tell you. So then I tried this one. I said, well, that's because you accumulated so many pious activities in your previous time that now you're living off those pious activities. And my mother said, well, you have accumulated so many, exponentially, so many more pious activities in this 20-something years you've been in, 28 years you've been in the Hare Krishna movement or whatever, that it should be vastly more than mine. So why are you sick? Why are you suffering? Why are you having these problems? So finally I had to write back and say, okay, well, probably because I wasn't sleeping enough, I wasn't eating properly, I was traveling all the time constantly, I was in top stress day and night. So then she writes back, finally, you're talking some sense. A group, this is the comment coming from the listener, a group which is just pushing down people and forcing them to feel condemned and always guilty. Oh, and here, I think this is a reference to Christianity too, that even from childhood, for example, you don't get baptized or something. And that you will be punished only because you are not a member of that group after death, and even put in hell. What kind of spirituality is this? And what kind of God are they making? Well, you know, obviously we don't agree with that, none of us. And we could, you know, walk around all day and kick the wall and say those blah, 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 people. I kind of see it like, you know, okay, that's the way they think, and what can I do about it? I have to just deal with it. I have to work around it. I have to somehow or another see it in such a way that it fits within my existence. I can't change the world. I can't change the way in which religions have developed. I can't change the way people think in general about their particular religions. This is not possible for me. But I can do one thing, and that is I can change the way I react to them. I can change the way I interact with them. And I can work to do things, to give another kind of understanding of things to others, and hopefully things will transform for everybody. More than that, I cannot do. And I also, it's like so common sense. If you've been engaged in what we do, it's like some common sense that the way in which God is defined in this manner is not acceptable to us. And the reason it's not acceptable is because it just doesn't, it's a human quality being pushed upon God. So even though, let me just make a quick conclusion, even though a group may be helping people to come in contact with spirituality to some extent, that doesn't mean that everything about them is good. And they say the same thing about me. I mean, that's life. There's good, there's bad, there's the in-between. You just have to live with it.